Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from the club's offices overlooking San Francisco's financial district. I'm Mark Stoner, your quarterly chair. We also welcome the listeners of radio station KPBS in San Diego, one of more than 225 radio stations nationwide carrying America's longest-running radio program. We invite all our listeners here and on radio to join us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now, here to introduce tonight's special guest is Tiffany Schlein, president of the International Academy of Digital Arts and Sciences, someone who San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown described as the digital diva. Tiffany?
I kind of want to do that gavel, but I guess they won't let me. We're very lucky to have Katie Hafner doing the conversation with Esther tonight. She's a writer for the New York Times Circuit section, and her books include Where the Wizards Stay Up Late, The Origins of the Internet. She also wrote The House at the Bridge, A Story of Modern Germany, and Cyberpunk, Outlaws and Hackers on the Computer Frontier. She's written for The New Republic, Wired, Upside, and many others. Now, before there was the internet, which I want you to all go very back in your minds, and God asked Adam to name all things in order to have power over them. And in a modern version of this tale, Esther Dyson was appointed as the interim chairman of the Internet Corporation of Assigned Names and Numbers, which pretty much places her as the most important person in the internet industry. She also does much more than that. She's the chairman of Adventure Holdings, a diversified company focused on merger information technology worldwide and on the emerging computer markets of Central and Eastern Europe. And she still contributes to the monthly newsletter Release 1.0 and wrote her first book last year, Release 2.0. Now, that's information from her bio. But from where I stand, Esther Dyson embodies the very industry that she evangelizes. She herself is like a packet of energy and information that bolts all over the world. And just like information knows no borders, Esther knows no borders, traveling worldwide to influence the power of ideas more than the power of money. When I first started the Webby Awards, I wrote a list of all my heroes and then proceeded to write to each one of them and ask them to be a judge. And I got an email back at 2 in the morning from Esther, and it was a really big turning point. Because we were young and her support was really priceless. And she remains one of my heroes as a technologist, as a business person, and as an intellectual. She paves the way for all peoples by the very nature of her inquiry, her vision, and her application of ideas. And she lives what she speaks about technology. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Esther Dyson.
Esther, it's very hard to know where to start asking you questions.
Especially after that intro.
You've been doing so much for so long. I thought a good idea would be to start with ICANN. First, tell us what it stands for, which Tiffany actually just did. And give us a little bit of its history, and it's also been riven by some controversy lately.
Okay, well, as you probably know better than I do, in the old days when they created the internet, it was mostly a government project funded by DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And among the people they funded was this guy at the University of Southern California called John Postel. And among other things that he was being funded to do, he kept a little list of all the machines that were connected over this internet and their addresses, which were numbers. And then they started giving them names. And then this thing grew. And it never had any legal standing. It's just like somebody's address list. And people began to rely on it to find other machines. It gradually gathered authority and legitimacy. It got to be a bigger and bigger task. And finally, the government decided to give out the management of the names of the .com, .net, and .org domains to a company called Network Solutions, which was a little company nobody had ever heard of in Washington. And they got this contract to manage this database of names and addresses for the internet. And it wasn't a very big contract, but the business, well, it wasn't a business. It was a contract to do it for free for all the users of the internet all over the world. And finally the government said, well, this is getting kind of expensive. There are lots of names and addresses. Why don't we let NSI charge some money and kind of get it off our hands? So what happened was they created a completely legitimate government-sponsored monopoly to manage that particular address space. Meanwhile, John Postel was still there doing the others, .us, .jp, not actually running them, but kind of being the person who decided policy disputes and so forth. And what usually happened was if somebody had a dispute, they would come to John Postel, and he would behave kind of like anybody's father and would say, okay, you guys go out there and figure it out for yourselves, or I'll knock your heads in and I'll decide for you, and you wouldn't like that, would you? So they would usually come to terms on their own, and John Postel would bless whatever had resulted, and things went on. But clearly the internet was growing, it was getting more commercial, the disputes got more serious, the trademark people got upset when people registered their trademarks as domain names and so forth. So in its wisdom, the U.S. government, in the person of Ira Magaziner, said, gee, I think it's time that the U.S. government should get out of this. It really shouldn't be managing what is a global resource, not a U.S. resource. It shouldn't be setting policy. This should be done by the internet community itself. The alternative, which a lot of other governments were suggesting, was it should be done by a worldwide government organization like the UN or the ITU. And God bless the U.S. government. They said, no, let's let the private sector do it. But as Katie said, that created a lot of controversy. The engineers thought it was being turned over to the ugly forces of commerce and big business. The foreigners thought it was some kind of a sneaky plot by the Americans to keep control of the internet. The Americans and many in American Congress thought it was a sneaky plot to give the internet away to dirty foreigners. And the commercial people thought that they just really didn't trust this kind of slightly unconcrete, diffuse notion of leaving it to a bunch of guys on the internet to run it. And even though they don't like government regulation, they like certainty and predictability, and so they thought it was kind of a dangerous thing to do too. And in fact, when I was writing my book, which actually came out a couple of years ago, I noticed this controversy going on distantly and tried to figure out what was happening so that I could write about it for my chapter on governance. But I got so many different stories from so many different people, I just said, well, this is an example of how the internet reaches consensus through discussion, and left it at that. And for that sin, I became invited to sit on the board of this thing. The idea was to make up a board of 9 people who were not part of these controversies, who hadn't really had a dog in the fight, and who were respected people, et cetera. So I ended up being one of them, and I was the only one foolish enough to volunteer for being chairman, and this was October of 98.
Which is when John Postel died.
In the meantime, John Postel had died in September, tremendously complicating things.
Quite suddenly,
of a heart attack after surgery. And he probably would have been chief technology officer of the Internet Corporation for Sign Names and Numbers. He certainly would have given it legitimacy and an aura of continuity and respectability, which we totally lacked. And a bunch of mistakes were made. First of all, the board was chosen in secret. Now, everybody knows it's hard to go out and pick people in public if you're trying to find people, but there was a sense that this had really turned into a secret process. The ICANN structure itself was pretty much seemed to be an agreement between IANA, which was what John Postel had run, and Network Solutions, and a lot of people felt left out. And finally, we had a set of bylaws, which were fundamentally the bylaws of a charity. A charity is something where some rich guy decides to give something to whomever he picks to receive it, and what you want to do is make sure that the trustees of this charity don't steal from it, but you don't really care much beyond that. A charity is not really accountable to the public. And ICANN, of course, was not a charity. It was something that is managing a public asset. only the technical parts of it, but still it's a public asset. So there were a lot of complaints that we were not accountable, and they were correct. And we fixed that more or less, although we didn't have open board meetings until just this summer. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, that created a lot of unhappiness and a sense that we were not accountable, that we were doing things in secret. Unfortunately, most of these board members who were very respected were not really comfortable going out on the lists and posting and being the victim of, I'm on somebody's address book as Esther the Clueless Dyson, that sort of stuff. You know, but it's not me, it's the position I hold, and so you have to remember that it's not personal. So that's what ICANN is. What we are charged to do is to manage, to coordinate the assignment of internet protocols and standards, to coordinate also the address registries which allocate IP address space, and finally to coordinate the management of the domain name system, which is the most political, controversial part. And we're supposed to do that on the basis of industry consensus. So the board is not supposed to vote its own opinions. It's supposed to vote its perception of what it perceives the industry consensus to be. And if you've noticed a lot of nouns without definitions in this, you're right.
Now there was some news very recently where there was an agreement.
We came to an agreement finally with Network Solutions because we have no power. All we've got is the ability to make contracts with people such as Network Solutions, which, of course, didn't really want to have a contract with us. But we were able to persuade them to do that because we were the successor to the Department of Commerce, which did have the contract. And we have contracts with registrars. We hope to have contracts with the other domain name registries over time. But we can't force anything on anybody. We have to do it through contract. And the reason I took this job...
Yes, I was going to ask you, why on earth?
Well, you know, partly it was by mistake. But... Partly, it is very exciting because this is a single facility that does need to be managed and coordinated and have policy set for it, ideally on the basis of what the community thinks. To set up a structure to do that, to keep it independent of governments on the one hand, independent of big business on the other, to try and make it more open and accountable, to try and give it a sense of humor, and to try and make sure that it doesn't try to do much.
And the question is, would John approve of what he's, if he were alive today?
You know, I think he probably would more than people think. One of the problems with, I've seen this before, with people who die, is that the people who follow them say, well, what would John have done? And they don't realize that maybe John was smart enough to change his mind or be flexible. And so... the things that people did in the name of Jesus Christ, some of them are pretty awful, and Jesus Christ himself never would have done them. And in the same way, I think people tend to have a fairly fixed view of John Postel and don't understand that he, too, would have evolved.
So you're interim chairman now. Is that anything like being interim CEO of Apple?
No, I've got a fixed date to leave. I'm actually formally chairman now, but I'm chairman only until next September.
I see. Well, and then recently you got some money from the Markle Foundation, a lot of money, actually.
Well, not compared to our budget, but $100,000 to help us. One of our other challenges is to get an at-large membership who can, in fact, vote on the board that will succeed us. Half our board is the original 9 members, and they were all, quote, initial board members, and I was initial interim chairman. Now there are 9 board members who were elected by the sort of technical subcommittees of ICANN, but by next September we need 9 that are elected by the at-large membership. And the challenge, of course, is who should our membership be? Every internet user, domain name holders, people who want to pay $50.
Well, what do you think?
Well, of course, I can only reflect the consensus, which is kind of hard to determine. But we're heading towards anybody who cares enough to register, to prove their identity. In the long run, we're probably going to charge membership. But in the short one, we're just trying to build this thing up. and we probably won't. So the Markle money is going to help also to do outreach.
Now I think I'll slip in a question from the audience because it's about ICANN. Do you think ICANN will ultimately become the international governing body of the Internet?
I hope not. The thing to understand first is ICANN manages and sets policies for resources. It doesn't govern people or people's behavior. So we don't actually have anything to do with privacy other than the privacy of the information you get when you register your domain name. We don't have anything to do with content, thank God. I mean, when someone comes to us and says, we want you to shut that guy down because he said bad things about us, we want to be able to say, we can't. We have no power to do this. It's not in our contracts. Our contracts simply say that if the registrars follow these rules, they can follow those rules. We can't shut people down. We don't want that power. Many of us on the board are, you know, we believe that this should not be the tool of governments trying to set policies for people.
Well, now, it seems like this keeps you very busy. What percentage of your time would you... I mean, you're a busy person as it is.
Well, it's about 50% on ICANN, 50% on my own company, 50% on startups, and 50% on...
wait a minute. Now, your mother's a mathematician, right? And she happens to be in the audience.
Yes, like
Tiffany's
grandmother.
But we won't hold it against her. So, right, so you don't... Well, we'll get to your personal life later. You wear a lot of different hats, and you serve on boards, and your company invests in startups. And the question has arisen from time to time whether there might be a conflict of interest. How do you keep Esther, the businesswoman, separate from Esther, the public servant?
Well, the first way you do it is by disclosure. Yeah, everybody's got conflicts of interest, and a lot of conflicts of interest aren't financial. They are, as you know, as a journalist, you're friends with somebody, and you don't need to be invested in their company to have a bias that you need to fight. And I've got lots of conflicts of interest, but they're all disclosed, and I'm aware of them, and you know, people can judge me by what I do.
Mm-hmm.
Vis-a-vis ICANN, obviously, I actually voted against our conflict of interest policy because I didn't think it was strong enough. The way it works is that you have to disclose it to a committee, and I think you should actually disclose it to the public. So I make a point of putting on my website, except for when we have problems with updating every company I'm invested in and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
How you do it, you know, I'm actually very interested in the ethics of all this, not just in being ethical, but...
And it also seems harder and harder in this day and age to keep it all straight.
Yeah.
Because, as you said, everybody knows everybody. It all moves so quickly. You must be asked all the time to serve on boards and invest.
And people ask you to invest on the boards of companies that conflict with other companies. And so many, many times I say, look, you know, I'm interested in this, but you have to understand I'm on the board of your competitor, so don't tell me more than you want to tell me, and remember, tomorrow you might not feel as comfortable as you do today. So just, I will represent to you that I'm honorable, but, and the way to be honorable is to tell people this stuff up front.
And do you think that, how would you say that the ethics of the industry, have people gotten more or less ethical as, you know, let's face it, there's just so much money out there to be made?
Well, there's a big difference between being ethical and being ethical or non-ethical and being greedy and just being driven by money. I mean, a lot of people don't have conflict of interest problems, but I think they're too short-sighted and too money-driven. I think the industry's problems are less conflicts of interest than, you know, sheer bad behavior, such as some of the Microsoft stuff. And Microsoft's not unique. They simply are uniquely powerful. But most companies I know would have behaved just as badly as Microsoft if they'd had the chance. And that's a pity, because it's not fun to win unfairly.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. What did you think of the... judge's decision, or
well, the judge's statement
rather.
I thought most of it was fairly accurate. The tone may have been overly harsh, or it may have.
We should probably interrupt, actually, just in case people didn't hear about this. Microsoft, the judge in the antitrust case,
said they were bad.
Yes, said they were bad. Okay, now we can continue.
But what is interesting to me now is, well, what's the proper remedy? You know, do you chop them up into little pieces, or do you slap their hand and say you were bad, be nice? Because Microsoft, I mean, this is interesting stuff. It applies to ICANN, it applies to Microsoft, it applies to the U.S. government, which is anything that has too much power is going to tend to abuse it over the long run. And that's why I think incumbency in government is a problem. So is monopoly in business. And it's why ICANN itself has to be very accountable rather than simply having a board make its own decisions. So in the case of Microsoft, what should they do? First of all, I think the first thing I would do, and I don't know if it's enough, but is simply to make them disclose every contract they've got. Because a lot of the abuses were simply contracts that were, you buy this from me and I'll let you have that. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't buy Windows from us, we won't let you have access to anything else ever, and we'll, that kind of thing. Simply making those public is a good first start. Would it be effective? You see, I don't want to punish, you can't punish a company. You can punish its shareholders. You can punish its employees. You can punish top executives. But the issue here isn't punishment. The issue is making sure that the marketplace is fluid and open and doesn't get stuck into one technology or one vendor. And how to achieve that, I'm not sure. But I'm not sure breaking Microsoft up into three is going to do much.
Your book, which predates all of this, I guess it was 2 years ago that it was published.
Yeah, 97, 98.
And some of the criticisms of the book, which is called Release 2.0, and it's now out in paperback as Release 2.1. Was your optimistic viewpoint, which some critics said even were even downright, your viewpoints were even downright utopian, and that you celebrated individual control, the rise of individual control through the internet and democracy and the free world, and you were criticized for assuming that the net will do a better job of promoting these things than the physical world. Are you having any second thoughts?
Not really, but let me go back one step. The book was optimistic, and first I would say that having the choice of being pessimistic or optimistic, I'd rather be optimistic and draw good, optimistic people into using the net so that, in fact, to some extent, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If people don't think they can get on the net, you know, if people don't think it's a place for families to communicate and so forth, then it will turn into a commercial swamp, a cesspool of pornography and bad people. So one goal of the book was, in fact, to get people to see this as something, as a tool they could use to control their own lives, not to control other people's lives. And that second point is why I actually am optimistic. I think a lot of, you know, I don't think the net is going to make everybody happy, and I did not say that in the book, despite what everybody says. But I do think that a lot of unhappiness in the world is caused by people abusing other people, people who have no control and feel victimized. And if you give people a tool that will give them power over their own lives, more information, more ability to reach out to other people, to communicate, to find out alternative jobs, whatever, that they will end up probably doing what they want to do more effectively, less likely to feel obliged to hurt other people in the process. And so you'll have a net gain, a small one. You won't have a huge tip in the balance, but you'll basically, I think it will become a better place because more people will get what they want and fewer people will be able to impose things on other people.
Now, what we're assuming, though, and correct me if I'm making a false assumption, is that there's access to the net for most people. I mean,
we're not assuming that. I mean, what we are assuming, the underlying assumption of this book is people are fundamentally good if you give them the chance and you don't screw them up. If you think people are fundamentally bad if you give them the chance, then the net is very dangerous because it gives all these fundamentally bad people more power. But the assumption is not that everybody has access to the net. I spent a lot of time in Eastern Europe.
I was just
and so I'm not right. I'm not that naive. But for people who do have access to it, it's a tool. For people who don't have access to it, it's still a tool for building better economies and hoping that someday they will get access to it. The mere fact that not everybody has it doesn't mean that it's unfair. The world is unfair, and access to the net is just one more thing that's unfairly apportioned.
And yet, let's dwell on this just for a minute, which is that there are a lot of people who have serious concerns about real inequalities that are being exacerbated by their lack of access to the net. And what do you... Where do they get it, and how does it change? It doesn't seem to be.
I don't think they're being exacerbated. I think the real problem in the United States is lack of education, and and that's not because schools aren't available. It's because children aren't brought up. I mean, there's no simple answer to any of this stuff, but it certainly does not begin with the internet. It begins with home lives, it begins with parents, it begins with teachers and teachers thinking, we need more respect for teachers, we need better salaries so better people will become teachers, etc. In the rest of the world, it's more economics. And, it's sort of like saying, well, not everybody can have an automobile, so let's get rid of them. Whereas I think automobiles, again, help make the economy work better and ultimately are going to lead to more prosperity in general. They will not solve the problem of poverty, neither will the internet. But if you go and see what people are doing with it in Africa or Eastern Europe, you'll see that it really is a great tool for sharing some of the benefits that just information access can bring.
Now, someone from the audience wanted to know exactly what your company does, Adventure.
Okay, well, it's kind of like the internet and decentralized, but the basic thing it does is it publishes this newsletter, Release 1.0, once a month, and we hold two conferences each once a year, PC Forum in the spring in the U.S. and Adventures High Tech Forum in the fall in Europe. And then separately from that, but run out of the same organization, there's my portfolio of investments in startups of all kinds. And that's basically what it does.
Now, speaking of Eastern Europe, you took a very... This is one of the things I have to say that I really admire you for. You took a very early, intense... I mean, Esther, you don't do anything really halfway. An intense interest in Eastern Europe, especially the then Soviet Union. And why did you get interested in it, and how have you seen everything evolve since you started?
Well, I really got interested because I learned Russian in high school. And I did that because I'd already done French and German. And my father had been there a few times. And we knew that even though the Soviets were bad, the Russians were good, to use shorthand. So in 89, I had the chance to go over there with, of all people, Gary Chapman, who was then executive director of Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility.
Another good guy, I should add.
Yeah, and Sherry Turkle, who wrote the book on the second self, children and computers and stuff like that. So we were a rather odd delegation, and when we arrived, they spent time with us for 2 days, and then a delegation of genuine German businessmen showed up. So they forgot all about us, and I spent 3 weeks there trying to remember my Russian. I called up the guy who had written Tetris, whose phone number I had gotten from Lee Felsenstein, who may be known to some in this audience. And, of course, he'd written Tetris, so I was kind of, you know, a very important guy. And whereas from his point of view,
I think he should be hanged, actually. But
he's now working at Microsoft doing.
Oh, okay. Doing, well, there you go.
Anyway, and of course, he got this phone call from this clearly very important American woman with an incredibly bad accent who must be very important because she'd come all the way to the Soviet Union. But we met up and became quite friendly, and I got introduced to all these other programmers. One of them had his birthday party on April 18th while I was there, and it was the social event of the season. And after 3 weeks, I came back. I wrote a piece that ended up in Forbes talking about Russia as a society of hunters and gatherers, kind of picking up the carcass of the Soviet industrial state, which was rusting. And this was at the time I'd just been to the Santa Fe Institute and was thinking about self-organizing systems, and the Soviet Union had no feedback loops. It was just, like ICANN, it was just intellectually tremendously fascinating, but a pretty horrible place. I went back in October on a little trip, and that was when we were over in Russia and we heard that California had slid into the sea, if you recall. This was the October of 1989. Mm-hmm. And then I went back again in December and was one of the first people to visit Zelenograd, which was this military city where they did a lot of Star Wars. And it was just incredibly boring. You know, Soviet general gets up, talks for 10 minutes, translation, talks for another 10 minutes. And at the end of the day, I was ready to leave, but of course I didn't have a flight. So the next morning I called in sick, called up all the programmers I had met in April, and had a ball for the next 5 days. Went home through Budapest, and this was Christmas weekend, the weekend that the Ceausescu's, the rulers in Romania, were executed. So it was a very intense time. And I felt homesick for Russia, which completely surprised me. Mm. And that was when I knew that I would keep doing this. But fundamentally what drives me is that it's not redundant. I like to do things that I don't think anybody else will bother to do.
Well, exactly. Mind you, nobody was interested in this area when Esther went to do this. Now, here's a question from the audience. Who are your heroes?
George Orwell is the first one I think of.
Would you like to elaborate on that?
Yeah. He was certainly an imperfect human being, and he wrote about imperfect human beings. He's remembered for 1984 and Animal Farm, but he did a lot more than that. He was a journalist who told the truth even when it was inconvenient. You know, if there was a labor organizer who happened to be a disgusting slob or ethically questionable, he wouldn't hide that. He had a very good understanding of the complexity of life. And things like this notion that conflict of interest is not just financial. He was in the business of telling the truth, and he wrote some incredibly wonderful essays. And he spent time living among the jobless on Wigan Pier. I've always liked journalists like you. And he's the one hero when I have to have only one hero. If you add others in, Kay Graham would be another. The uncovering of Watergate, mm-hmm. and her. Of all the things that troubles me about the internet, you know, aside from the fact that it reflects human nature and some of that's pretty ugly, it is how journalism's going to be funded. And Kay Graham, with a family fortune behind her, put journalism over the financial advice of her advisors. And if I were giving away Bill Gates' fortune, I'd give a fair amount to ensure free and open journalism as well as education.
And then there's politics on the internet. And one question is, How has the internet changed politics, and can I get elected? The questioner is asking this, by the way, not me.
Well, how the internet has changed politics is not much yet, although it's clearly beginning to happen. What the internet does fundamentally is it erodes central power. If broadcast is a good medium for propaganda, the internet's a good medium for conspiracy. And that's independent of whether you consider the central authority to be good or bad. The internet undermines it. And it's extremely disturbing to anybody in the establishment, whether it's big business, big government, big media, big church. It gives people a way not just to talk back, but to talk among each other and discover that there are other people with common interests. The whole business of direct mail organizing was just a precursor to what's going on now with the internet, and that, in some sense, is why the Republicans, in many ways, get the internet much better than the Democrats, because they were always much more in the grassroots organizing kind of business. So what you see now is Bradley and everybody else has websites, and it's kind of fashionable. But I hope that the real thing that the internet will do is first foster local activism. And you can write a letter to President Clinton. You can get back a canned answer, although they only send, I don't think they send email back. I think they want your paper address, whatever. But the way people, there's the perception that you can write email to the government, and then there's the reality of you can actually make something happen. And that is going to happen on the local level first. Now, my Pollyannish optimistic view is that people are going to get into the habit of feeling that they have power, that they're going to start exercising it, not by toppling the president, but by getting a new stoplight put in where they need it, or by having more information about the performance of the school board and getting better schools. And by having that power, they'll feel more invested in the government, whatever it is. They will get more active. They will feel their opinions count, and they will count more. I've said this three times in the last 3 weeks, but I'll say it here too. The notion, for example, that electronic voting is democracy is akin to the notion that sex is marriage. You know, it's just one little transaction, and there's a whole lot more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's discussion, it's involvement, it's coming up with ideas and solutions. It's not simply voting on what's put in front of you. And so I'm hoping that the net is going to change people's feelings about government, not just which medium is being used, but give people an actual way to participate more.
Well, now you mentioned direct marketing, and that speaks to some of the questions that have been filtering in here tonight, which is all about privacy. A lot of people are more concerned than ever about privacy, and and what can be done over the net is actually pretty horrifying. There's a lot of, I just, in fact, wrote a story about this. There's a lot of ignorance out there about what can really, what these direct marketers and these profiling companies can do, and the kinds of databases that are merged and purged, and how we are really followed click after click through cyberspace as we shop and do other things on the net. Now, you've been very involved and outspoken in this debate over whether there should be legislation or whether there should be self-regulation on the part of industry. I'll let the audience hear from you where you stand.
Okay. How many of you are concerned about privacy out there in the audience?
Looks like there's about everybody raised their hand.
Almost everyone. How many of you at the same time value having vendors know enough about you to give you... this is not a trick question. I mean, it is a clear contradiction. How many of you feel that if you can control the use of the data, it's actually very valuable for vendors to know enough about you to give you exactly what you want? Okay. And the contradiction, of course, is not that you don't value your privacy, but how do you maintain control of the information? How do you make sure that it's used for the purposes you specify and not for others? And my basic feeling is that I don't see it as government versus self-regulation, because I don't think the industry is going to regulate itself. I think the industry needs to be regulated by consumers. The question is it going to be regulated by consumers through the medium of the government with fairly rigid laws that are pretty restrictive, or is it going to be regulated by consumers through the market with the ability to express their preferences in a very fine-grained way? For that to happen, which I think is the ideal solution, we need a number of things to happen which aren't there yet. First of all, we need much better tools for consumers to maintain their own data, express their preferences, not just what the data is, but how it should be used. And then second, you need clearly on the other end enforcement mechanisms to make sure that companies actually do what they promise they will do with the information. And there's an organization called Trustee where this is a great example of conflict of interest. I was chairman of...
Please disclose.
Yes, I was chairman of the Electronic Frontier Foundation when EFF and CommerceNet co-founded it. I have no official position and certainly no monetary interest in Trustee, which is not for profit. But at the same time, I'm very biased. I want this thing to succeed. I'm well aware of its inadequacies, which are that its licensees are, of course, companies who believe that privacy is important or that it's an issue. And so they're the ones that are least likely to break its rules. And therefore, Trustee has never really shown its teeth. And it also, I think, fell down on the job a couple of times, like when GeoCities, which was a Trustee licensee, was doing bad things with its users' data but was not actually breaking the Trustee license. Trustee kind of mumbled and shuffled and let the FTC take care of it. It did the same thing with Microsoft. Most recently, in a little dust-up with Real Networks, Trustee did show some teeth, and it said, look, even though our contract says only websites, as opposed to the kind of data Real Networks was collecting, which was through software, through a communication channel that was not a website, Trustee made it clear that they had broken the spirit of the Trustee license. Real Networks agreed to change its ways, to apologize, to no
but
longer...
But only when it was busted.
Yes. And I mean, Trustee ain't perfect, and it needs to get better and stronger. And frankly, it needs to have a couple of cases where it really does just bust somebody's chop so that people will take it seriously. But at the same time, if you're going to go around doing that, it's hard to get licensees. So there is a challenge. How do you get the industry to agree to this regulation without somebody beating it over the head with a stick? And somebody is beating it over the head with a stick. The Federal Trade Commission says, if you don't do this, then we're going to come in and regulate us, and that would be even worse. And, of course, in Europe, they have much stronger privacy laws. Meanwhile, I'm trying to get the SEC to make a ruling that you need to disclose your privacy liabilities in any kind of financial statements. And privacy policies are becoming a liability, just as environmental things are becoming a liability. So what we're hoping to do is to apply enough pressure on companies.
Wait a minute. Now, how is it, just to back up, how is a privacy policy a liability?
How does a privacy policy...
How is it a liability?
No, a privacy policy is not a liability. Breaking one is, because then you'll get sued. Mm-hmm. If you have crummy privacy practices,
I see,
either on purpose because you sell data or by mistake because you're careless with it and your security is lousy, then you have a genuine liability which should be disclosed to investors. And therefore, companies will go and get audited. They'll make sure that their practices are okay. And the challenge is to apply this in a way that doesn't end up with one size fits all. But at the other side, you need better educated consumers. You need privacy policies that are intelligible to normal people. And you need a little bit of stick on the other side. But I don't think what you want is strict government regulation that makes things too inflexible. If you need government regulation, I think it should be about disclosure and living up to promises rather than about specific practices.
Now, one of the fascinating things I found in reporting the story is that on one end of the spectrum are people who really are vigilant about their privacy. On the other end are people who just don't care at all and welcome the intrusion, actually. And then, but in the middle, where a lot of people seem to find themselves is sort of this trade-off that they're willing to give up, as you mentioned earlier, they're willing to give up certain bits of their privacy for, say, convenience or a discount. So that all plays into it, and I think that the marketers know this.
Yeah.
And
I mean, it doesn't trouble me that there is a trade-off. And I think people should be able to make those choices. I personally have no phone at home.
No telephone at home.
No telephone.
You're famous for having no telephone
yeah.
at home.
And it's a choice I made. And other people make different choices.
Now, what's the reason you don't have a phone at home?
I didn't like being called at home, and I didn't like calling people from home, because when I go home, I work late, and then I just go home, and I'd rather read or sleep. And I think way too many people feel victims of the technology. You know, oh, my God, I've got my cell phone. I always need to answer it. One guy complained about how much television he had to watch. You know, it's... I think people... And, again, this is part of what the book was trying to tell people. You have a choice. Exercise that choice. You can turn your cell phone off. If you have a boss that makes you keep your cell phone on, you can find another job. I mean, no, it's not easy, but people are grown-ups. And when you go to Eastern Europe, you see what people turn into when they're treated really like children and have no self-respect and no feeling of choice at all. And it doesn't mean that you make only selfish choices, but it means you make your own choices.
Now, you live pretty much a virtual life. I mean, you're on the road a lot.
Yeah, but that's not virtual.
Oh, all right. Well, you're very reachable by email quite often. And you have two very interesting looking bags at your feet here. Now, what are I'm interested in what some of your personal gadgets may be.
This was not planned, but what the hell. It's this is the fun one. This is my beautiful Sony computer.
One of these ultra-thin, ultra-light.
Yes, and it's very old and kind of battered looking. And
oh, my goodness gracious. The cables, I should just describe for the radio audience, the cables and the adapters for all the different
this
countries.
This is for England. This is for elsewhere in Europe.
Many different cables and sockets and batteries. And in fact, I think all of this is far heavier than the computer itself.
Power supply. And two phone cords, because one of them was kind of breaking. And
do you have a cell phone?
No.
A pager?
Oh, and my Ethernet card and my other card in the computer and a spare battery. No cell phone, no pager.
No Palm?
No Palm.
No WinCE device?
No. Yeah, you see, I'm actually not very techie. I have one computer that I love and put everything in. And don't back up enough. And none of these other devices. I don't have a belt loop with things hanging off it.
We can attest to that.
Yeah.
Now, while you're gathering all that together, I'll ask you another question. From the audience, what do you see as the next big thing or killer application on the internet?
Well, depending on whether you're looking for financial things or what have you, clearly the next big thing is wireless. And interestingly, Europe is ahead of us in wireless. God bless them. They have the GSM standard. Interestingly, when you talk about the digital divide, wireless is a lot more accessible to people, both in terms of being cheaper, in terms of being much easier to use, both in terms of being easy to understand and also easy to use on a street corner. This thing is kind of inconvenient I've actually used it on the subway on occasion, but it's kind of inconvenient. You can't really take it out on the street corner while you're waiting for a friend. And many, many people are going to be using the internet through wireless rather than through PCs and devices like this. Other stuff, just lots of email tools, things that make the net easier to use, more the equivalent of maps. If you look at the internet now, it's kind of like wandering through the dark with a flashlight, and you see one thing displayed, and then you see another thing displayed, but you don't really have a sense of where you are. There's no sense of neighborhood or peripheral vision. And what the net really needs is better maps, better street signs, better vistas. You know, when you go into a restaurant, you look around, who's here? Are they well-dressed? Do they look happy? You go to a website, and there's nobody else there. You can't see who's there. There are now annotation tools so that people can annotate websites. There are other tools that tell you who's there or how many people are there. So a lot of that kind of semiotics of the web, I think, is another big area that's going to develop.
Right. There are some of these companies that are they're turning websites into sort of public squares. And
which I think is great. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there are all kinds of issues. Who should control what people say? Is it censorship if it's a private place? That kind of stuff. And very interesting issues they are. But clearly, the community is pushing back very hard to say that you can't censor how someone annotates your site. You can sue them for libel if you think you have a case, but you can't stop them from having a third-party server that will kind of put plastic over the site with people's comments on it, and I think that's great. Now, of course, a lot of the stuff is junk, and so there are going to be private annotation sites, sort of like private discussion groups, where people can say anything, but there's a moderator and there's some group desire for quality.
Back to Eastern Europe. What is the most unique application of internet technology you've seen in Eastern Europe?
Well, you know, unique isn't really the issue. It's useful. And it's the same old stuff. It's using email. If you want a nice anecdote, there's a company in Poland that has, it began as a medical publisher. It was selling ads to pharmaceutical companies, and it noticed that their salespeople were tremendously inefficient. You know, traipsing around Poland, taking orders from doctors, lots of paperwork. It took months for the paperwork to get back. And so they developed an application, and now these pharmaceutical salesmen are using, and they're mostly salesmen in Poland, they're using Palm Pilots. And every day after a hard day's work talking to doctors and selling pharmaceuticals, they upload their orders and their data to an internet server through the Palm Pilot. And, you know, it's not what you really think of as happening first in Poland, but it does. There's car auction sites in Russia. There are also lots of NGOs in Russia that are using the internet to keep...
NGO, that's
non-government organization. It basically... not-for-profits, charities, and stuff like that. If you come to Moscow and you get trained to run an NGO and do something about local environmental problems or something, then you go back to your village, and there's nobody to support you. Getting on email and just being able to communicate with the people, your peer group of fellow activists or fellow people trying to do a small lending program or something is tremendously important. George Soros has been a really big force in getting the internet into Central and Eastern Europe, and it has done a huge amount of good. It's been a really fundamental infrastructure he put in to support NGOs and education and stuff like that.
And what role does Silicon Valley play in helping to increase technology penetration in Eastern Europe?
Minimal. It sells the products, but sometimes people ask, you didn't, but why live in New York? And one reason is that in Silicon Valley, people really forget that they're not the center of the world. And there's just a sense that this is where everything happens. And in many ways it is, but in a lot of other ways it isn't. And in New York, they think they're the center of the world, but they know that the rest of the world exists. And in Eastern Europe, they're kind of peering in from outside, and they're so excited. The internet here is kind of a consumer plaything. The internet in Eastern Europe is a miracle, and it gives them access to stuff they couldn't have before any other way. Here, it's a handy replacement for the 800 number.
Business-to-business commerce is the next big thing for the internet. What's the next step after that? What's your vision for 2020?
Okay. I should have mentioned business-to-business. I think two fundamental things are going to happen. One, there's going to be a kind of backlash, not in terms of not using the internet, but in terms of valuing real experience, in terms of valuing personal attention. We're going to automate everything and make it nice and convenient. And then you're going to really like a human being's smile. Tourism is bubbling up all over the place. Virtual experiences are not the same as the uncontrolled reality of everything from bungee jumping to going to a village in Morocco and actually buying these wonderful sugared donuts they have. Or I was in Uzbekistan, and you ride along the road, and there are people selling tea. It's just, so one is going to be greater value attached to actual experience. The other is everything's going to be hooked up. And so I think a lot about swimming pools.
Say again?
I think a lot about swimming pools. Swimming pools are very unvirtual. There's a swimming pool somewhere in Munich. I don't know what temperature it is. I don't know what time it opens. I don't know how long it is.
We should interject here that Esther's a big swimmer.
I swim every day. And in the future, everything's going to be hooked up, and I'll be able just to go to the internet and ask a sensor device, how hot is the pool? When does it open? The world is going to be virtually present, all the bits and pieces of it. You're going to have little chips in your luggage so that you will know that it got lost in Paris. It will still be in Paris, but you'll know where it is.
Great.
And so, again, we're going to have to make more choices because you can know everything all the time. You have to figure out what it is you want to know. You can reach anybody anytime. They need to decide to whom they want to be accessible. So the virtual world right now is very virtual. It's not very connected to the physical world. My computer doesn't have a clue where it is. It doesn't know what's around it. But in the future, everything is going to... It won't be aware, but it will carry the information. You'll be able to query everything, for better or worse.
Well, I'm going to sneak in one last question. It's a question very close to my heart. What advice do you have for those who find computers too complicated and too frustrating to use?
Complain to the vendor. Second, don't use it if you don't have a reason to. If you do have a reason to, you'll probably figure out how to do what you want. But remember, it's a tool. And people say, well, how do you get more people onto the net? That's not really my goal. My goal is to help people who want to do something use the net to do it if it's going to help them. So have a purpose beyond the use of a computer.
Well, on that note, our thanks to Esther Dyson, Chair of Adventure Holdings, and the Internet Corporation for assigned names and numbers, and our thanks to all of you. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.